nanohub.org.
Online simulation and more for nanotechnology.
And today we'll be covering transmission electron microscopy. I'm going to now turn the DS over here to Dr. Smith, Dr. James Smith. He resides in, he works at Princeton University in the great state of the Garden State of New Jersey. And then Mr. Glenn Johnson from Salt Lake Community College. I think he's in the lab today, it looks like, at Salt Lake Community College. So, Jim, why don't you take it over?
Well, thank you very much, Bob. Bob and I have worked together for a number of years, and he invited me to talk a little bit about transmission electron microscopy. On the bottom of this slide, I do have my email address that you can feel free to use if you want to get in contact with me for further discussion. Glenn Johnson is the person that's going to be giving our demonstrations today. He's at Salt Lake Community College, where he'll be using a tabletop TEM that was purchased actually when I was still teaching at Salt Lake Community College before I came to many years before I came to Princeton University. So that's kind of the cast. And let me kind of get into it. So what we're going to talk about today is technology education. So basically, we want to talk about this sort of from a technician education standpoint, some of the things that we tried to accomplish at Salt Lake Community College. And so there's not going to be a lot of mathematics or a lot of the more than just sort of the basic physics that goes behind the use of a transmission electron microscope. And we really love transmission electron microscopes when we need to see the smallest details of different types of chemical, physical, and engineering projects that we're looking at. We can get images down to the atomic scale. And I just have on the slide listed some of the materials characterization things that can be done with a microscope. And this includes not only the traditional materials, which are kind of the hard, solid materials like ceramics and metals, which we've been using for some time, but also through various techniques that have been developed over the last 30 years or so, biological materials, soft materials. And now even I've seen ways to do both liquid and gas analysis with special specimen holders that have been developed. So there's really any materials on the table. And that's something that makes this such a powerful technique, as well as the wealth of information you can get from a single technique. In the mid figures here, in the middle is a 1950s level transmission electron microscope, and you can see all of these appendages sticking off of the outside of the microscope. Those were actually where you would manually intervene to insert certain apertures and those types of things and make adjustments and movements there. The upper is actually one of the transmission electron microscopes here at Princeton University. And it is, you can see that the microscope is completely encased in an environmental control chamber, completely separated from the area in which the technician sits. There's no more need for inserting and taking out different parts of the microscope. So we've come a long ways in sort of making it easier to use a transmission electron microscope. And I wanted to point to this particular image here. This is actually a 3 megavolt transmission electron microscope. So this is one of the, I think it is a version 8000. But basically, these electrons move extremely fast. And so what is it? What does a transmission electron microscope do to make an image? Well, it actually shoots electrons through our sample. So as opposed to the SEM, and we basically take those electrons after they pass through the sample and we collect them to make different images or different things about our sample. So in order to build one of these, no matter whether it's one of the old kind or whether the new kind, they all have some common elements. And those would be, you have to have a source of electrons. And then you need some way to control the electrons as they move, usually from the top to the bottom through your electron column. And that's through electron lenses, which are electromagnetic lenses. And we usually have a series of apertures to select the electrons that we want to use for our final image. There's always a vacuum system involved because electrons will collide with air molecules, which will ruin your image, right? They also a lot of the electron sources will be corroded or corrupted by the presence of gases and those things. So just for the lifetime of the microscope, you need this. So we're talking usually about high vacuum to ultra high vacuum, 10 to the minus 10 type vacuums in certain parts of the microscope. That's in TOR. You also have to have a way to make the image, to form the image, and we'll talk about how they did it in the past and some of the new ways that they're doing it now. And then many times we combine other detectors and other things in order to enhance the amount of information we can get out of transmission electron microscope. The one Glenn will be using actually has an SEM mode. So there's a secondary electron detector in with the rest of the unit, and he's able to flip between modes so he can look at the same sample, which is nice. Just some terminology. Okay. Electron microscopes come sort of in three different levels. The low voltage levels are below 200 kilovolts. Those are usually used for soft materials like biological samples, polymers, and they can also be used to characterize nanoparticles and things like nanotubes, those types of things. Medium voltage microscopes, usually 200 to 400 kilovolts. These for general materials research and are usually the ones that you see in most university laboratories and companies. The higher voltage, like the one I've got pictured here, means 400 to one. In fact, 3 megavolts is this newest one here. And higher voltage always means higher resolution, better penetration, but on the other hand, it also means that those electrons can damage sensitive materials more easily. So there's always a trade-off when choosing the electron microscope that you'll be using.
I have a question for you.
Go ahead.
Is that really like 5 stories high?
Yes, really. The person sits down in this little room right down here at the bottom. So you got to remember that you have when you really juice up an electron with a lot of voltage, it moves very quickly. Mm-hmm. And it takes some distance to control it with your electromagnetic lens. Mm-hmm. So you have to expand the microscope column as you move electrons faster. So, you know, the higher energy electrons, you'll actually see them be faster. And in fact, that's why they're housed, for example, in these big cabinets like this that are very, very tall, because the column takes up the majority of the height of that particular cabinet, even though this isn't, you know, in the megavolt range. And, you know, if you stood next to this, this is taller than a person. And they're also very, very sensitive to vibrations. And so you'll see in even the most critical imaging situations, they're usually located in the basement of the building because there's less motion due to people and things moving around. Sometimes they're on isolation floors that are completely separated or somehow dampened from the rest of the structure of the building, those types of things. So it's very, very important that the environment and the not only the vibrations, but also the temperature and everything is controlled. So I wanted to compare a little bit of what we're doing in a transmission electron microscope to both light microscopy on the left and scanning electron microscopy on the right. So some of you may have attended the earlier session, which we had on scanning electron microscopes, and the other one on focused ion beam microscopes. You may already be familiar with some of the parts of the microscope. But at the top, for a light microscope, our source is some sort of an illumination. For both the TEM and the SEM, it is what we call the electron gun, which a lot of times is either made out of a piece of a material like tungsten that's heated to a high temperature to emit electrons. But more likely in modern microscopes, it's actually what we call the field emission gun. And so what this is a crystal or a piece of material to which a very, very high electric field is applied, or around which it is applied. And we actually suck the electrons out of that material through a tunneling process. And so you have either cold or hot cathode versions of this. And basically a cold cathode means there's no thermal heating. Hot cathode means you put a little thermal heating just to help it, the electron, coax the electrons out. So you don't need as much electromagnetic field to pull the electrons out of the material. But once electrons are generated, they're sent down a column through these electromagnetic lenses, which are shown by the rectangular boxes. In light, of course, the light beams go through a series of optical lenses, usually made out of some sort of glass or a controlled refractive index material. Okay, as opposed to the light microscope, where the shape of the glass is what basically steers or bends the photons, in the electron microscope, basically it's the energy or current put through the coils. We'll talk about that in another slide. In the TEM, like a light microscope, the electrons pass through the specimen and then through another series of lenses before they form an image. Just like in a light microscope, a transmission microscope, the light comes up through the material and then goes through an objective lens and then through your eyepiece lens into your eye to be detected. So we'll talk about each one of these stages a little bit separately. Now, the SEM is somewhat different because the electrons in that particular microscope are scanned across the surface at the bottom, and those electrons are not, well, not in first hand used to generate the image, but usually there's a set of detectors that detect other things that are produced by the impact of those electrons. Not so in the transmission electron microscope, where we're actually trying to collect the electrons that do pass through in order to form our image. Okay, so that's a really big difference. And that's one of the reasons that also the columns on the TEM are so long, because not only do we have the same stuff we were doing beforehand in the SEM to try to get the electrons to our sample, but we've got a bunch of stuff we have to do after they pass through the sample before we can get our image. So what are these electromagnetic lenses? So you may have made electromagnetics back. I think I made my first electromagnetic thing in Cub Scouts when I was about 8 years old. So that was, unfortunately, a lot of years ago. But basically, the idea is in an electromagnetic lens is that we pass a current through a wire, right? And it goes inside of various materials, usually magnetic materials, that then create a magnetic field at the poles. Okay, and so when something that has charge moves rapidly or at some velocity V through a magnetic field, right, it feels a force called the Lorentz force, and it depends on the cross product with the magnetic field. So what does this mean? This means that electrons who pass through the center of this field that's created inside of this toroid or this circular lens, they pass pretty parallel to the magnetic field. And so because this is a cross product, we know then the force will be really small. So they continue on through relatively unimpeded. It's the electrons towards the periphery that have come from an electron source that they're more perpendicular to the magnetic field. They feel a stronger force, and this force basically bends them towards the central axis, which we still call the optical axis inside of an electron microscope, even though we're not using photons anymore. Just tradition, hard to break certain traditions. But if you really want to get down and nitpicky about the way the electron moves in the field, they actually move in a spiraling fashion by this Lorentz force, and they spiral in smaller and smaller loops until they come to what we call crossover or focus right here. And then the electrons will continue to expand after that point, and they can be used to form images later down in the column. So that's more or less just a small idea of how we steer and control the electrons inside of our microscope. Okay, so what happens with the electron path? Okay, so from the source, we have a series of lenses. And these top two lenses, basically, which we call condenser lenses, there may be one condenser lens or multiple condenser lenses in a microscope, but they're basically going to start to control and shape the electrons into a beam. So they're going to control the size of the spot. And also they're going to be used to control the intensity. And electrons that we just can't get a good control of because we can't quite focus them correctly, we could use a series of apertures to block out stray electrons. So we have a well-conditioned beam. Once it meets our sample or specimen, which is located right here, it's the smaller red part. Right before this beam reaches the sample, there's an objective lens, which basically focuses the sample in the way we want it to impact or to hit the beam. The beam will then, some of the beam will then pass through the sample. And on the other side, we have a lower objective lens, which is basically to take the electrons that remain and to, again, control them and control the beam such that it will form an image. Then we have some intermediate, this may be one or two electromagnetic lenses, which will take aspects of that controlled beam and form our initial image. And then our final image is projected on something that will display the image. Okay, so this is different than a scanning electron microscope where we're picking up these electrons in a detector, and the detector signal was then used by a computer to generate an image. We actually take these electrons and we impinge them on something that will create an image. So that is also a little bit of a subtle difference between transmission electron microscopes and scanning electron microscopes. I wanted to talk a little bit about the way we get those images and the importance of the vacuum again. So these are kind of the last two components in our list at the beginning. So images, there's basically the traditional method was we used to have a fluorescent screen, and the fluorescent screen would have the electrons projected upon it. And when they hit it, they were, through cathode luminescence, right, there would be transition in the fluorescence coating, and it would create a green glow where there was a high intensity of electrons, and where there were no electrons, it would be dark. And then there would be various levels of brightness in between. So if you ask a transmission electron microscopist what color electrons are, they'll tell you they're green because they used to stare at these green screens for a long, long time. All right. And then you would usually use a camera or something to then capture that image and display it on a screen. Or if you wanted to take a picture in the old days, you'd actually replace that screen with film, or you would divert the beam towards some film, and the exposure of the film would create your image. And then you would take that out, process it, and put it in your paper. I used to actually tape them onto my papers, and then we would make a photocopy of them to send to the publisher or scan. So that was kind of the old school. Of course, we've gotten better, right? So the next step in evolution was that we would use something again to convert the electrons into photons. We call those scintillators. So they would usually be a crystal like a YAG crystal. And then we would focus a camera on top of that crystal, and then we would go into a computer to do the imaging and image acquisition. There's a little different version of that, which actually Glenn uses in his microscope, where they actually use the scintillator to create a photon image, and then they focus an optical microscope on there to do additional magnification. And it's something that makes it possible for his particular microscope to be very small and sit on his desktop next to him. And that's actually shown. This is actually a picture in the bottom right-hand part that shows exactly what his microscope sort of looks like. So you can see his column is a matter of a few inches tall. How do they get away with that? Well, instead of using electromagnetic lenses, they use permanent magnet lenses, which have very strong fields. So you're able to control these. And then he uses this optical microscope column on the top to do some additional magnification. And his YAG crystal is right here at the top between the microscope and the column. And he's able to insert his specimen over here. Also, the fact that we use a vacuum becomes a really big deal in sample preparation. So samples that don't work well under a vacuum, like anything that's liquid or liquid-based, right, we have to take special precautions to use them. And this is possible through several different techniques or specially designed specimen chambers. I wanted to show you on the left and the right just a few little details of what you'll be seeing. We're going to do two different imaging modes today. And one of them is a bright field imaging mode, where we'll be able to actually see the items that we're looking at based upon the electrons that have passed by them or through them. And we'll be using a diffraction mode, where we're actually going to be using the electrons that are scattered by the material to try to find some things about the material structure and its symmetry and those types of things. So we can get both of these things. But in order to do this, the big difference is right here in the middle, this aperture region. So after the electrons have passed through our specimen, which is this purple line here, and they go through our objective lens, we then can use a set of apertures. So we use one aperture here, which basically allows us to block diffracted electrons and try to narrow our electrons down to only those who passed relatively unimpeded through our specimen that transmitted through. And that's how we make what we call our bright field image. Okay. And it actually forms an image down here on this plane, about this region, from the objective lens. And it turns out that if we remove that aperture, but instead we select an aperture that's wider that allows the diffracted beams that are on the outside to come through and blocks a little bit of the transmitted light, then we can get a diffraction pattern. So that's basically the difference. So we're trying to make use of all the different types of electrons that make it through our specimen. And we'll talk a little bit more about diffraction in a minute when we're ready for that demonstration. So again, just kind of zeroing in a little bit on this. So you often see bright field and dark field images. So on the left, again, this is just, this is, we're zooming in on what's happening to the electrons after they've passed through the specimen. And now they're going through our objective lens down here. So here's our image that's coming down and it goes through to an image plane. So if, again, if we insert basically an aperture here, we can select only these electrons that are coming through the center, right? If we were to look at our, if we were able to crawl into our microscope and look up at the electrons coming at us from the objective lens, we would see them coming down in a pattern that looks like this. Okay. In the center would be the beams that were relatively unaffected by transmitting through the specimen, coming straight at us, just as they were shot at us from the top of the, before the specimen, right? And on the edges, we would see the ones that had been diffracted because they're now moving down different paths and they're interfering with each other to create this area of spots. Okay. So I want to block all of these with this red aperture here and only take the center ones. That's going to give me a bright field image. Okay. But I can actually rotate my beam so that I could bring some of these side spots through this center aperture and I could get what we call a dark field image, which is where I'm actually using electrons from diffracted beams to form my image. Okay. And so that's what's happening over here. They show this as actually shifting the aperture over to select a particular diffracted beam. But most of the time it's actually done as is shown here on the right, where we actually just tilt the beam coming in so that now the diffracted beam is turned and goes down to the aperture. Okay, so just a small point, but an important point when you're operating your microscope. Okay, so what are we going to expect to see when Glenn does this or when people do these types of images? Well, this particular image actually shows two bright field images on the left, A and C, of a platinum crystal with its multiple grains. So you can see the grains, right? And now the contrast in these images on the left are because it was hard for some reason for the electrons to get through the sample, mainly because of thickness. Or maybe there was some sort of imperfection in the sample, like a grain boundary that caused the samples to, the electrons to scatter. So they appear dark, right? Or maybe we get some banding like we do here in C due to maybe some internal structure. Maybe there's some stacking faults or something like that in there. So that was all made by using the central beam, right, in this red circle. But if we take some diffracted beams right here, we can actually get these interesting dark field images. So it turns out that grains that are oriented so that they create these diffracted spots are the only grains that will be, that will show up here in this image. So this is really interesting, especially for material students. I love to show these images to my students because what does it mean that these grains diffracted those images? It means that the actual atomic planes inside the grain were oriented in such a way that the electrons would shoot down between those grains and get diffracted. And we can actually index and say what orientation that grain had. So I could say, okay, that's a 1-1-1 grain, for example. And so now when I look at my image, only the grains present in my image that were oriented so that I could see the 1-1-1 plane will light up. All the other grains were oriented in some other orientation like 0-1-2 or, you know, 3-2-1 or whatever. They aren't going to light up. So this is very interesting. So I can control the grain orientations in my sample that appear when I'm looking at hard samples or granular samples like that. So that's a detail that you don't get as easily out of other types of microscopy experiments. So we'll mainly just be seeing bright field images, and just a little side bit. So again, I talked about thicknesses and maybe defects or subgrain structures that may make it hard to see certain images. The other thing that happens is if you have one of those grains, like I talked about, oriented so that the electrons are diffracting through them, they actually also turn back, because if it's really, really efficiently diffracting the specimens, those are not going to make it to our central beam. They're all going to be scattered in that surrounding pattern. And so those grains will also appear dark. And in fact, in this specimen on the left, these darker grains are because what we call Bragg diffraction loss. So they become that. And we can confirm that because when we see some of those grains in the dark field image, all by using the diffracted beams, all of a sudden they light up very brightly. But again, we can see some maybe some subgrain imperfections that are lining up that we might want to investigate on further analysis. So without further ado, let's get down some practical applications. I'm going to turn this over to my colleague, Glenn, in Salt Lake Community College, and he's going to take control of the screen and show us some images. And he's going to talk us through some of the ways that they go through with community college students, educating them about transmission electron microscopy.
Thank you, Jim. So I want to share the microscope with you guys. So what you're looking at, of course, our large image, and I'll explain briefly what we're looking at there, but over here are all of my controls. And then I put on here that control panel, the console, and this is what I'm going to be using on my end to control the microscope. Within our image, Jim talked about thickness. So with this microscope, we're able to look at anything 50 nanometers and below. And our grid, you can kind of see it. It's a smaller area, but these really dark areas, that's like a crosshatch pattern. That's our TEM grid, and it's over 50 nanometers. Thus, it's black. We can't see anything. So we want to investigate down in here. One thing that I will mention, and this will come into play a little bit with the next sample that we look at, there's a 5 nanometer carbon backing on these. So we're already dampening 10% of what we can see. So in the next sample, things might show a little brighter. So I'm going to be using these knobs down here, magnification, and this, it's called high voltage, but it's the acceleration voltage. These are the two I'm going to be manipulating the most. And then anytime I use anything else, I'll point it out briefly. But first, I'm going to start magnifying. And you can see my magnification, my real magnification over here. When I first start out, I'm just at 1,400 times magnification. But as I turn this, we're going to zoom in, and I can always look there to see what my real magnification is. As it gets darker, now I need to start manipulating the electron beam. I'm going to do that by using my acceleration voltage, which you can see the value right up here. So as I change this value, you're going to notice that the image will start getting a little bit brighter. Now you can see where my beam is. This is the challenge of using a TEM, is trying to keep this beam centered while you're magnifying and also manipulating your acceleration voltage. In order to change this, up here's a little button called beam shift, and then I use these two little corrector knobs down here, and I always go the wrong way first. And I just try to keep this centered. So then as I magnify, as I continue my magnification, I want to make sure I'm in an area that I can see. So it's, again, it's just a constant game of keeping this centered while you're magnifying, but also I need to continue to adjust this beam to brighten things up a little bit. And then when Jim showed the diagrams, there was a crossover, which is right there. You see how everything kind of switched? I'll back up. So that's one of those crossovers. Now, again, I'm going to continue to try to keep this bright, zooming in. I'm just going to go all the way to what the max I can do here. You notice I'm at 70,000. I currently have the 4x objective lens in the carousel. That's what I'm currently on. What I tell my students to do is magnify all the way into 70,000, and I can focus this a little bit if I'd like to, but make sure that you're in a spot of interest before you go and use the 40x objective lens, which is going to make everything, you know, a higher magnification, because you want to make sure you're in a spot before you switch that. If I just switch over to this other one real quick, now there's a 40X. I have no idea what I'm looking at, no idea where to go. So back to this 4X. I'm at 70,000 times magnification at this point. Luckily with this specimen, and by the way, we're looking at gold nanoparticles, they're all over the place. So I really don't have to search too far to find them. You'll notice things are a little bit out of focus. On the microscope, there is a knob called the Z knob. And when I move this, it's literally going to move. It's going to push down on the sample rod, and it's going to move the sample in a Z direction. Thus, they call it the Z knob. And because it's physically moving it, you're going to notice that the image kind of jumps around when I touch it. And I'm barely touching it, by the way. But when I do so, I can really clear up the image quite a bit.
So rather than bring the microscope closer to the sample, you're adjusting the sample height to get the image in focus.
Exactly. Yes. Yeah. So now that I've got, let's say this is the area that I want to look at. Now what I would have my students do is I would have them back up and I'm just going to reset everything. I'm going to turn all the knobs all the way back to the beginning. Okay. Now I'm going to turn that the objective carousel and bring on my 40x objective lens. So now you notice my real magnification is at 14,000 instead of 1,400. Things are a little blurry. Also on the microscope, just below the objective, that 40x objective lens is that YAG crystal that Jim mentioned. There's a little dial where I can adjust that. I only adjust this in the 40x because it's actually going to change the working distance. And I don't want to do it with the 4X because I could end up damaging switching back and forth. So I'm just very carefully going to turn this and try to see if I can improve my focus. Now I can start doing the same thing as before. I'm going to start zooming in, manipulating the electron beam. So I'm kind of doing both at the same time. I'll go ahead and stop here for a moment. You'll notice, let me brighten it up a little bit. And right now I'm using the electron beam to brighten it just by lowering this value over here. But you notice everything is way out of focus. So what I have him do again is gently adjust that crystal, try to get everything into focus, and then again go to that Z knob because that's what's going to bring everything into a fine focus. And you'll notice when I use it, things are going to jump around. And if things get worse, you're going the wrong way. And if you go the right way, you can bring things into relatively nice focus. So currently I'm at 77,000, which I'm at what the 4X objective maximum could do. But I'm just going to continue to go in and adjust the beam. And as I do it, if I want to, I can go ahead and continue to change the focus so I know what I'm looking at. With this, it's all gold nanoparticles, so it's all going to look relatively the same. But I do notice as I'm zooming in, I'm getting more of this matrix in my image. So I'm going to select an image shift on my control panel, and I'm going to use those corrector knobs. And now I can move my sample around to a nice area that I'm interested in. Otherwise, we have a little joystick. And if you're at, 185,000 times magnification, joysticks don't work too well at high magnifications. So at least this way, I can move in very small increments. Let me go ahead and try to see if I can clear that up a touch again. Okay. So again, I'm just going to continue. Now, just like we had a crossover earlier at the 4X objective, it happens with that one, I think somewhere around 27,000 times magnification. You're going to notice when I get 250 to 270,000 times magnification, it's going to happen again. And when it does, now it's really out of whack. So I need to make that correction with my Z knob again and just try to see if I can get this. And again, I'm going to use that electron beam to try to brighten it. Now, I'm barely moving this knob to adjust the electron, the acceleration voltage. If I move it too fast, you can easily get lost and lose the beam, and it can be a little bit frustrating. But let's try to get here, nice area to look at. Brighten it up a little bit using the beam, and we'll continue to zoom in. So it becomes a little bit repetitious until you get to the point where you want to take your final image, which I'm going to try to get to in a moment. I'm just going to blast this right up to 700,000. So now I've reached the maximum magnification that I can with this objective lens at 700,000 times. But I want to try to focus this a little bit. So again, the Z knob. Well, I'm sorry. First, I'm going to use that YAG crystal just to make sure that I've got it in decent focus. And then I go to that Z knob. There we go. It's decent. I could probably play with it quite a bit. But like I mentioned, when you touch that Z knob, it can really move things around and be a little bit irritating. But move this into somewhere. Sorry, I'm trying to find a better spot, and I'm going the wrong way again.
we've got some good agglomerates of nanoparticles.
Yeah.
You can actually see the individual nanoparticles kind of sticking together.
So when I'm, let's say if this one, I want this to be my final image. Now that I'm set and I'm fairly focused, I don't want to play with it too much. If you, I don't know how well you guys can see the screen, but it kind of looks like it's moving a little bit. Now you can see all this noise in here. So there are some adjustments that I can make. First of all, I can use this exposure, and this can control my brightness. And it's just like shutter speed on a camera. So maybe I want to increase that to 500. Let's see how that does. It brightens it up quite a bit. The reason I don't do this while I'm making my adjustments is you're going to get a lag, and it makes it really difficult to make your adjustments when you have a lag. So that's why I wait until I'm ready to do my final image. Another thing I can do, I like to bring up a histogram. And Sam will put this on manual. And I can just come out here and drag and slide these. And then I can make fine adjustments. And whatever my eye likes the best, I can find an image that I like. The last thing I have my students do, you'll see the summing right here. It's currently set at 1. This is what's going to eliminate some of this noise. So I'm going to turn it up to 3. And you'll notice it might move just a touch, but it's pretty much frozen. Measurements. So I can select this measurement, and I can just do a click and drag, get an approximate measurement of that nanoparticle. That one's about 23 nanometers. There's a smaller one up here. That one's about 15. We could search around all day. We could probably find one under 10. It looks like we got a small one over there. That's about 15. So this is like a quick and dirty how we can zoom in real fast, take some measurements, manipulate our image. Again, you see things are kind of getting out of whack. It'll drift a touch, and then I can just make this adjustment to my histogram. Last thing I want to mention about this, same with the histogram as with exposure. I don't want to have this up and running, the histogram, while I'm making adjustments. If I start zooming out, you can see what's going to happen to that histogram. It's going to start getting way out of whack. So that's why I save all of this until we're ready to take our final image. Any questions?
So Glenn, in your experience with students, what tends to be like the biggest, well, other than getting the sample into the microscope, which is a total different question.
Once it's in there,
what seems to be their biggest hang up?
To speak to that, I do not allow students to do sample exchange because it's, you mess one thing up and it's down for a while. So I handle that. It's just experience. Just like with any microscope, as they get used to using the dials on this console and the finesse that you need to use, it's not something you can just spin really fast. You have to really dial in on things and be patient. Maybe patience is the word I'm looking for. With a lot of microscopes, everything's in real time. You can just zip around and do what you need to do. With this, you need to be patient. Know that it might take a while to get the exact image that you want. And by a while, I mean 15, 20 minutes. Just real quick for this one, you know, it's a 3 millimeter gold grid that we had, and it has the carbon backing, that 5 nanometer carbon backing. Mm-hmm. So we made our colloidal gold, and I just use a pipette, put a drop mm-hmm. on it, and let it dry.
It's similar to the SEM then, right?
Very similar to the SEM.
Except
your sample
grid is 3 millimeters in diameter or so.
So I'm going to put this up by the camera. I don't know if you guys can even see it. It's probably out of focus. So that makes it much more difficult to work with when you compare it to the SEM.
Mm-hmm.
And also with our 50 nanometer thickness as far as projection. So now we're looking at, you know, nanoparticles. We use carbon nanotubes, for example. And even in our SEM mode, I think our limitation is 1 millimeter in thickness.
Okay. But in TEM, you said it's 50 nanometers, basically.
At the projection, anything above 50 nanometers in thickness is going to turn out to just be black. It won't have that grayscale to it.
I was just going to say that. So the other thing that in order to have a 400 kilovolt TEM, you need a transformer that's about as big as like a really small smart car. And those aren't very handy to have in your lab. And so his microscope, I think, is max. What is the max acceleration? 5 or
6?
6.
Yeah, 6. 6. So you can see it right up here.
6 kV.
Right there. Yep.
And they have a newer model, this particular manufacturer, that goes up to 25 kV. So if you remember on for my slide when I talked about, that's low voltage in the TEM world. And it's primarily going to be useful for very, very thin samples, like Glenn said, or samples that are made out of low atomic weight materials, like biological samples that are specially prepared, or polymer samples, or things like that. So, you know, it has its niche, which is kind of along those areas, and more like these nanoparticles and nanotube type analysis. But for the images that I was showing of platinum, et cetera, you couldn't do that in this microscope easily. Again, usually the rule of thumb is 100 nanometers or less, unless you have something like that 3 megavolt TEM that I showed you on that page. And then you can have very, very thick samples to examine. But in most cases, the rule of thumb is to get it below 100 nanometers. And I'll talk to you about that. In fact, that is a good segue right now. So he is going to change the sample, which means he needs to break vacuum and reestablish vacuum, which always causes a time delay. So we'll use that time to talk about exactly how we make samples. All right. So I've divided this into some different types of samples and sample preparation. So the first one is hard sample preparation. What I mean is usually metals or ceramics, crystalline structures. They can be amorphous structures, but they're going to be ones that you can easily handle without any problem. So there's a lot of different ways actually to prepare these samples, but I'm going to follow a common one, and one that I've used in the past, and you can always look up other procedures. They're all over the internet and easy to find with Google nowadays. But we're targeting less than 100 nanometers. And so the first thing that we usually do is we take a sample and we try to cut it out the area of interest that we need, you know, so we may be using dicing saws and things at this end, and we're going to be grinding it down to somewhere on the order of, well, about 500 microns, less than a millimeter somewhere in there, so that we can still handle it easier. The thinner we make it in this step, the easier we make it on the other steps. But if we make it too thin, then in our transportation, it might fall apart or break. And then usually at this point, we punch out our small 3 millimeter ring. So for metals, that's pretty easily because you have a thin foil now and you're just physically just punching it like you would punching other metal pieces in manufacturing. And so you get these small pieces, and then those pieces are brought through the next grinding and polishing step. So usually we grind and we polish these things down to 100 micron, and we try to get them smooth. We don't want any deep scratches or grooves because we don't want that to take, you know, as long as we're not damaging the microstructures that we're trying to look at, in doing this, we take it down thinner. And then we go down to what we call dimpling. So dimpling is a grinding tool. You can see it here in the bottom right-hand corner. We're basically spinning a grinding wheel, right, with a very, very fine grit on the end. And we're taking our sample in the middle and we're rotating it at the same time. And so what this is going to carve out the center of the sample in a little dimpled action. And we do this until we get the sample down to about 20 microns or less in thickness at the center. Okay, at the center time. So we're still nowhere near 100 nanometers at this point, but we've gone about as far as mechanical polishing alone can take us. We can then go to electric mechanical polishing or some other methods, but more commonly what we do is we do ion milling. So now basically what we do in this picture here in this bottom part is we take our sample and we rotate it and we shoot argon ions at it. And the argon atoms start knocking off atoms from the surfaces in this very thin section in the center. And we basically keep doing that until we make a hole in the center. Okay, and so when we make a hole in the center, then what we do know is that around the edges of that hole, we start at zero at the hole, right, in thickness, and it goes up as you go towards the edges till, you know, 100 nanometers or even more. And so it's only along the edges of that hole that we can actually do transmission electron microscopy. But we still have the edges that are thicker, so we can still handle it with tweezers, et cetera, without just breaking it to pieces. Okay. Now, the probability of getting a good sample going through all of these steps is actually relatively low. You end up breaking samples, dropping samples, samples getting blown off the top of the counter because you accidentally, you know, brush your hand by it, and just the wind from your hand will knock these samples, you know, to who knows where. Glenn's laughing because he's probably done that with a few of his sample grids. So that's one way that we can use samples.
So what does it take to prepare a sample? Like how long to prepare one sample?
Days.
Seriously?
Yeah.
Wow.
This is not a fast technique for samples where you're taking them from a large sample and you're sectioning out pieces of it. Now, glands take a matter of just how long it takes to dry. And in Utah, that's pretty fast. So he probably he probably spends half an hour dropping his nanoparticles on the grid, and then he's ready to go in the microscope. So that's probably on the very fast end of sample preparation. You know, the long end is more what I'm discussing right now.
So it seems like you're an artist when you're making this thing.
Yes, yes, you are. You're a sculptor in reverse. Yeah, you're basically you're a sculptor forward. You're removing all the stuff you don't want and trying to get that nugget that you're trying to get in the TEM. Now, in the semiconductor industry, it's not only important to get a sample, you have to get the right part of the sample. Right? Where the defect actually occurred into your TEM. And so we use focused ion beam, which if you attended an earlier session, and we have a recording that talks more about that technique. But basically what you're doing is you're basically shooting ions at the sample to carve out the unwanted portions and leaving the wanted portion. Sorry, I'm going to use my thing right here in the middle. So this thin section in the middle in B is what we want, right? And so we use the ion beam to carve this out. And then what they do is they bring down a tip and they use the ion beam to weld it to the sample. And then they go in and they cut the sample out. And then they lift the sample on the end of that little sample probe. And they go and they place it on their electron grid. And then they use the ion beam to tack it down to the grid and to cut it free from the sample manipulator. And voila. Again, a sample that takes hours, if not days, to accomplish all of these tasks, right? And then that sample is then transported very carefully into the transmission, before they transport it, they flip the sample around so that it's in the path of the ion beam, and they do the remainder of the thinning until they get down to the 50 nanometers or the 20 nanometers or the 100 nanometers that they need for the transmission electron microscope. That sample is then transferred into the transmission electron microscope where it is examined like we did before using bright field imaging or other types of imaging. Now, that is a very hands-on, intensive, technician-intensive process in a one- or two-off type situation. You don't have that kind of time in the semiconductor industry. So they have these large instruments that are down here on the right-hand side that do this automatically. They're cassettes of 300 millimeter 12 inch wafers that are already prepared for examination come and are set into this machine. And it literally goes through and in an automated way does exactly what we showed in these upper figures. And I don't have time really to show this video, but I'll try to release my slides to you. You can watch this video. It's a very good depiction of how this process occurs. So it's all automated. Again, no technician interfering. They're standing outside. All they're doing is loading the cassette in the front, and then the samples are coming out the back. And they even now have these that are integrated with the TEM itself so that all occurs within the shelter of a protected environment. And there's really no human intervention.
How long does it take to go through that process, do you know, Jim?
So it cuts it down quite a bit because you don't have the human factor, you know, of the fact that like humans like to sleep. So they're not always there to take on the next, next part of the steps. You know, there is... You know, so those types of things. So it does speed it up, but it's hours, fractions of days. You know what I'm saying? And they're doing a lot of different specimens. So, you know, these machines are just running as fast as they can. It's still not down to a half an hour like Glenn does. And the last slide that I have before we get back to Glenn's samples is this on biological specimens. So biological specimens, now we have to worry about not only thickness, but we also have to worry about whether or not it's just going to explode in the vacuum. Or shrivel up or do other things that are going to distort it in such a way that you can no longer recognize what you're trying to see in your biological specimen. So what are the things we're looking at? We're looking at cytoskeletons, membranes, organelles inside of it, even down to the molecular things that are happening inside of the cell itself. These are all accessible to us inside of a transmission electron microscope. So the way we do this is basically shown on this right-hand side. The conventional way we did this was through some sort of chemical fixation dehydration route. What does that mean? I treat this with chemicals that actually basically solidify those organic bonds and organic structures in there in such a way that they will not, even under some surface tension, et cetera, that they will not change. Okay. And so that tends to use a lot of things like osmium and other types of metals, which you don't really want to have in your lab. So it can be a little bit dangerous. The dehydration is also interesting. We actually replace the water with, for example, alcohols or other types of things through a series of soaking steps and treatments at different temperatures and pressures until we get this right. Because what we want to do is we want to get it down actually to carbon-containing compounds that then can be sublimated out of the sample without shrinking it. Because those capillary forces, when something dries, are very, very strong on cells, et cetera. And they just crinkle up into little puckered structures and you'd actually see the cell structure at all. And so we want to avoid that. Then we usually embed them in sort of some sort of plastic. And then we move to a sectioning technique. And that's where we actually use microtomes to slice off thin slices, believe it or not, on the orders of tens to hundreds of nanometers. And those are what then are stained with some other types of chemicals to provide more contrast and go into the microscope. There's another route that's been developed over the last 20 or 30 years through cryo-TEM, where we can actually skip some of the other steps and take some of these fixated, and we can cryogenically freeze them and look at them in very, very cold stage microscopes. Okay. So there's a few different routes and selections here, and we don't have a lot of time to dwell on that. But if biology is your area of interest, there's a lot out there. And since we're not going to be doing this in the TEM, I thought I'd put a little eye candy on this slide as we get ready to transition to back to Glenn and using the microscope. But we can see many cross-tissue samples, like the examples over here. We can see actual viruses in these particular ones that I'm showing. And we can look at liposomes, for example, or we can focus in on muscle tissue and look at different parts of that. So there's a lot of very interesting things we can use on biological or see. Using transmission electron microscopy. Glenn, I'll let you take over.
Swapping out a sample for this, we have to let the vacuum pump back down for about 5 minutes. So that's, thanks, Jim, for covering me on that one. With this one, so we're going to look at, these are some sheets of graphene, and then we'll do the diffraction as we zoom in. But right now, it's as we're all the way back, you can really see how this grid, so it's a much smaller grid than what we were using with the other sample of the gold nanoparticles. But as I zoom in here, we can start to see our different layers of graphene sheets. So what we know is anything that's black is over 50 nanometers, but we can see the varying grayscales of these graphene sheets. So where it's brighter, it's thinner. Where it's as it increasingly gets darker, that's increasingly getting thicker. So what I'm going to do is try to find an area here where I can kind of show you. So let's come over and we'll look at this guy here. Let's get that beam back out of the way. Okay, so now you're starting to see the different layers, if you will, of some of these graphene sheets. But what we really want to look at is we'd like to check out some diffraction. So ideally, I'm going to try to find an area with fewer layers, so there's not as much. And I can kind of see maybe right down here, I think there's a brighter area. I might go for that one. We'll see how easily I can get to it. So again, it's a game of manipulating your beam, trying to keep it centered as you zoom in and work with that acceleration voltage. See, that one got crazy. So I'm making mistakes because I'm trying to rush through it. So that's why
when patience, you're right?
Yeah, patience. That's the biggest factor with students is keeping their focus or trying to tell them, don't get frustrated. I've been doing this for how many years and I'm still messing up. So that's part of the game. Let's see, let's try to bring this up and try to center that image. I notice with my image shift, I've kind of hit the boundary. Over here, you can see where I have image shift and we got this little box and my cursor is all the way on the edge. So I've reached the limits that I can use that image shift. And at this height, I don't want to play too much with that joystick because it's going to just zip off somewhere if I'm not careful. No, that might have helped. Okay, so we'll just come in here and we'll just see what we can get. So there's 70,000. Okay, so I'm in here. So what I need to do next is I need to reduce this beam to a small point. And what's lovely is you can see it's kind of misshapen, so I want to get it the smallest that I can. And then I need to remove my objective aperture. And that's on the microscope, so I'm going to take this out. Okay, and then I'm going to select, here we go, diffraction here. Let's see what we get. And then I can adjust my acceleration voltage to try to kind of fine tune this. And Jim, you're the master of what we're looking at.
So basically we're looking at probably the diffraction pattern through several layers of graphene. And basically, remember I said that if you were able to crawl in to a TEM and actually look at that image coming through the specimen and through your objective lens that's after the specimen, you would see multiple spots, right? The main spot in the middle is those relatively unaffected electrons that are hitting us basically in the face. And the spots outside are the ones that are diffracted by the planes of or by the structure of the material that have been knocked off of that main axis. And so we've basically taken that objective aperture out, which was blocking those diffracted beams. And now we're actually able to see those, right? And it turns out that what we're looking at is based upon the spacing between these dots and the center and relative dots, we can actually begin to figure out which plane orientations are responsible for those dots. And because we're looking through multiple layers, right, they're not exactly little points. If we had an actual single layer of graphene, there would be little points and you would see a six-fold symmetry to the way those points. You'd see a hexagon of points basically around the center point. And it shows up really, really nice. And I'll show you some pictures of that I've got on my slides. But yeah, thanks. So this slide, just briefly, that grid that he keeps talking about, that's this little 3-millimeter diameter grid here that we can put our samples on. And it's usually made out of gold or copper or some other material. And then on top of that, a lot of times we coat it maybe with a polymer or carbon because those nanoparticles would fall right through the grid. So they got to sit on something. But carbon is light enough molecular weight that the electrons go through it fairly easily. So it's a standard thing to use when we're putting our samples together. I'm not going to talk about Bragg diffraction because you can see a lot more about that in the X-ray diffraction presentation that was given several weeks ago. That's one thing to note, that as opposed to X-ray diffraction, electrons, when they diffract, actually, they make a very small angle, actually about 0 to 2 degrees. And so those diffracted electrons from multiple planes end up in those spots that we saw Glenn make in the diffraction pattern. So on the right is actually what you would see, this area here. This is what we would expect to see if actually we were looking at a single graphene sheet. And this was actually made with the same microscope Glenn's using by the company that sells it. And as you get multiple layers, this is two layers, I believe, you start to see more and more spots. You see these rings appear, which is more like what we saw because we were probably looking through several layers, more than two layers or three layers. But this is just really an interesting view of just different types of diffraction patterns that you can find.